Hello, this is Brian Cam, and you are listening to Clear Story, a podcast which is normally a monologue in which I talk about literature, philosophy, and the history of how we know things. But this podcast is part of a series where I release conversations that I've had with people on Twitter Spaces. If you don't use Twitter or you don't use Twitter Spaces, this is just a way of hosting a live audio conversation on the internet. By default, it has a sort of host with an audience and you can invite people on stage. So this is an experiment in releasing some of those conversations which have just been sitting on my hard drive until now. So I hope you like the conversation that we had and I look forward to hearing from you. If you would like to schedule one of these conversations with me, please reach out. I am Brian Cam on Twitter. I'll include that in the show notes. And you can also find a link there to schedule a future conversation with me if you would like to do so. And with that, here's a conversation from earlier this year. I am Brian Cam, as you know, writer and independent researcher, occasional podcaster. I'm intermittently podcasting these days. And you are Isabella Granik, professor of psychology, and you are also working on Tech for Good. Would you like to say a little bit more about those projects? Or
sure. So yes, I am right now kind of splitting my time 50-50 between doing what I guess would be more traditionally considered professorial, or at least doing research. So I'm funded by the Templeton Foundation for the next 5 years to design, build, and evaluate different kinds of interactive technologies that help promote emotional resilience and prevent mental health problems like anxiety and depression. Mm. I particularly work with and for young people, so thinking about teenagers and children and having them help us design and then work through these interactive apps and games in particular to prevent anxiety and depression. And so that's part of my work. And then the other part is to create tools and share those tools out with the greater community of industry folks who really care about mental health and well-being and who want to apply scientific principles and techniques to their design of technologies. And so we are developing tools that we can then share with other people so they don't make the same mistakes we have over the last decade or so, and they can be more effective and efficient at what they build. And then we also help academics. These same tools should help academics care a little bit more about design and engagement and delighting the young people or the users of this technology, because they tend to be very concerned with the science and the sort of frameworks and conceptual level of what they're doing in terms of building interventions, but they deeply do not care about the individual who has the experience as they are engaging with the technology. It's not that they don't care, they just don't pay attention to that kind of thing usually. So right. We're trying to build a toolkit that then gets, then allows both the scientists and the designers to work together to create some of the same kinds of technologies we have. So that's my kind of academic science work. And then the rest of it.
Can I interrupt?
Yeah, sorry.
When you say toolkit, is that primarily software or?
Yeah, it's both. In the end, what it will be is like in the most practical level, a website where you can download a bunch of exercises and mindset practices that first and foremost help your team build a team that is transdisciplinary. And we have a set of ways of talking with one another, of how to hire people, how to interview people very differently than what you normally would do in an academic context, for example. And then, so those are part of the toolkit. The others are very practical, interactive tools like pipelines where you know how and when to hire the designer versus the programmer versus the, you know, research assistant, and how they all work together and when they should be getting together and to talk and when they should be testing stuff and et cetera. So these are very interactive timeline tools and milestone tools. And then finally, we have these like videos and written pieces of sort of experiential examples that we have ourselves gone through and then also have teams go through so that they can basically make their own mistakes really early on, see how they cope as a team when those mistakes are made, and then provide a whole set of options into how to repair those mistakes early on. So that's kind of the global context. So it's a bit of technology and a bit of just more, how-to sort of things.
Sort of interpersonal, like methodology or something like that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And so, sorry, I interrupted you. You were saying the other half of the
chapter. Yeah, so that's about 50% of my time, which is like sort of has a pretty, you know, clear framework of what the hell I'm doing. Mm. The other half of my time is being spent right now exploring all sorts of different ways of participating in and supporting and perhaps help creating creative collectives of some sort. So these are, in my mind at least, you know, proto-seniuses, very teeny tiny versions of collectives, so groups of people who share values, who are inspired by one another, who could be very, very different in across like, you know, personality types and so on, but who want to come together to, you know, live and play and experience a whole range of, you know, either projects or, you know, life goals kind of thing together. And so I'm doing that right now in a very casual, participatory way with folks like yourself in a Bloom collective, but also and in another kind of collective that's more community-based and very physical, but also some international groups that I'm becoming a part of. And these are communities that care deeply about reinventing financial models of living with one another. And so they're looking at radical generosity and how to, they're basically communes, but they're communes online that want to figure out how to do this in a long way and with many people across generations. That all sounds extremely vague, I know, but that's the part that is the really exploratory part of what I'm hoping to keep working at.
No, that's amazing. And so it sounds kind of like the first half is providing a framework for creating transdisciplinary collaboration within existing structures, whereas the second is more like creating new structures within which those collaborations could take place. Is that fair?
Beautiful. Yeah, it's really fair and a very generous way of giving this shape. But it is actually increasingly true that I see these two things that I felt were quite disparate and different. They are starting to cohere in really surprising and lovely ways. For example, the toolkit that we're funded to build and then disseminate to industry and academia is becoming increasingly more focused on building hybrid, or how to build hybrid experiences. So they're not, it used to be that we were completely focused on first video games for mental health.
Yes.
Then, you know, more interactive, social, but still digital experiences. And now increasingly with also the other groups that are joining us in our larger network that we are able to fund through this kind of seeding project, we are increasingly those projects are working at the interface between offline and online experiences and social experiences in particular. And so that immediately starts kind of melting into a questions about what kind of community would you want to be a part of these digital experiences that are there to promote emotional health and you know, social well-being and so on. And so, yes, by the way, we start finding that small groups for around 6 to 10 people of like-minded people who are there to support each other on a regular, predictable basis really does wonders for one's mental health. So you can see how these things now start feeding each other. And that part's really starting to get exciting for me.
Right, kind of informing each other and potentially overlapping in, I guess, experimental or practical ways, I guess.
In both, yeah, exactly. I start finding that my, what I, you know, the life that I am trying to design for the next 10 years coming up is very much aligned with the projects that the Gem Lab is sort of supporting in terms of seed funding and incubation, right? So just as one example, one of the projects that we are going forward and supporting is a social meditation platform, which I'll be able to say a lot more very soon once we launch our partnership with them. But the beautiful thing about their goals is that they're so aligned with what I would ideally like to be using with my children in a larger community of practitioners over time in the next decade, right? So we can think about what we want for our own lives lived, as well as my work is very much aligned with that. So it's just, it's delightful, that part.
And would it be fair to say that some dichotomies are collapsing between the online and the virtual, between the maybe academic and the social, or other kind of, you know, because you were saying that these are sort of opposite poles that are now coming together. Is that, is there anything
Absolutely.
To that, you think?
And yeah, and it's not just a very cheeky way to actually transition to our topic of today's discussion, but yeah, it's absolutely that. I mean, part of my frustration with academia and why I left full-time academia is that there was very little room for serious as well as playful discussion of the very practical day-to-day impact of our work and our thinking. And there was always that last section in a grant that you talk about knowledge translation and how is this going to be really relevant for the real world, i.e. the taxpayers that have paid you so much money for this grant, right?
Yes.
But it was always an afterthought.
Right.
And now I find so much joy in thinking about the everyday impact of any of these ideas, like, you know, how do we practice thinking in less in dichotomies or strict categories and working and playing in these tensions. And that has a direct relevance on how I, you know, raise teenagers and how I talk with my friends about how my, you know, all of it. So I do think it's very much aligned.
And it sounds like that's a dichotomy, sort of the ivory tower versus the quote unquote real world sort of, or
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And it reminds me of what Sam was saying. Yesterday, I interviewed Sam Biagetti, the historian of Historian Splaining podcast, the Twitter Spaces up on the profile. And his view is that there's only history and physics and everything else is just like a subset of those two. And I was thinking about that today because, and there's also, what is it, C.P. Snow, the two cultures, right, that he was writing in the 60s about the sciences versus the humanities. So hopefully we can like, and I think that's one that you're, that is a dichotomy that you're also particularly interested in, right?
That's right. I mean, there's a really good example, right, of, I mean, apologies to those who haven't heard that discussion. You can go and listen to the recorded version. The reason why I think it's actually really important to highlight again here, as you have, is that by saying something so, well, you know, controversial, I think he called it a hot take, around there is only physics and history, is that actually his discussion of that particular choice of dichotomy was all in the tension between those two things and how all other disciplines and thinking practices and so on are somewhere in the middle of these two tensions, and actually that we are really none of those actually make sense to just collapse it into. And so again, that discussion was all the more fruitful because you had, on the one hand, these categories to bounce off of, but on the other hand, to actually feel like reality is somewhere very much smushed in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, this is making, I'm sure there's something in Isaiah Berlin where he says, like, oh God, I'm gonna have to look this up later, but it's something like, all dichotomies are false, but they're also illuminating or something like that. And so he's trying to, yeah. So maybe we can talk a little bit, yeah, so about how he chose the title of the room and about dualities, dichotomies, kind of on-off binaries, and yeah, how that discussion came about. I mean, one aspect of it is this distinction. Well, it feels like there's a lot of ways in. I don't know. Do you have a sort of starting point? I was immediately going to theory and practice, and then
go for it.
Universal in particular, but I'm actually not sure that those are like, you know what I mean? Like those are not binaries exactly, because they're kind of interdependent, right? But yeah, I don't know. Where would you like to start, actually?
Well, so there's two things there. I mean, just start right there, because I think that dichotomies or categories can be of different sorts. Again, categorizing the categories, right? But there are these kind of these polarities, the yin-yang polarities, or like the Tao discuss a bunch of very meaningful everyday polarities that we can talk about. And I think they do actually call them polarities. And it's within that tension between these polarities that pretty much life can be explained or experienced, etc. And then they also, and you also in your last podcast/monologue, talked about these polarities, as some of which can be explained as having an interpenetration relationship. And to me, that is a mind-blowing kind of tool for thought, if you will. Like in thinking about how one is the instantiation of the whole, or a particular is an instantiation of the whole. There's so many really interesting insights. So I think if you could maybe give us a little bit of a background of thinking about theoretical versus practical, and then how this concept of interpenetration really relates to that. I think that would be really useful as just a foundation.
Yeah, the theory practice one is interesting, right? Because on the one hand, they do seem like they can be independent, you know, even within this ivory tower split, you can remain in a land of pure theory or pure mathematics, or, you know, kind of without regard to application. And sometimes those theoretical developments are really like end up being important in practical ways that are not only unforeseen, but unforeseeable as they develop on this like more abstract theoretical side. And then you can also seemingly, you know, make assays or run experiments or just physically do stuff in the world without having any pre-existing framework or theory of what you are doing. Like often it helps to have one, but you can seemingly do most of life without one. But then, you know, through experience, you form these abstractions. And I guess, and so then, you know, in a certain sense, like if you're going to learn from experience, that's already classifying experience in a way that you could call theoretical, even if it's just, you know, don't touch the, you know, fire or whatever it is, right? And so I kind of mentioned like offhand in the, I was also thinking about this, like, this debate in medieval scholastic philosophy, which I was really into about 3 or 4 months ago, and now I've sort of forgotten, but it's about this universal particular divide. And one of the things that I kind of mentioned in that podcast, which was in some ways a return to that, but through the lens of Goethe, who's, you know, on the one hand a poet, but also a kind of scientist, natural philosopher. I think he was like a botanist, was it?
Yeah.
And so, But what I was thinking about is, because I said it in the podcast just as a throwaway, which is like about the species and the individual, right? Because without, like, the species is a kind of meaningless concept in the sense that it's not meaningless. It's that you never encounter a species. You only ever encounter members of a species, right? And so there's the instantiation of this kind of abstraction. But then without those instances, it would make no sense to have a species, right? Like, so it kind of both depend. It's like there's this tension between, well, it is the universal and the particular. And this is the scholastics were really hung up on in the like 12th century, which is like, if we think that the most important types of knowledge are abstract or, about classes of things. And yet, when we live our daily lives, we never encounter any classes. We only ever encounter, concrete individuals or concrete examples. We don't encounter the classes. Then, how is that knowledge formed? And what is the relationship between those two things? And there's kind of a spectrum from Platonism, which says, well, there's this kind of metaphysical realm of classes where of pure forms or pure classes where which we can never experience, and yet all quote unquote truth comes somehow from that part of the metaphysical landscape, I guess. And then there's this other kind of extreme, which is that there are no classes at all. Those are purely projections of human minds onto things that are in, well, in whatever reality is, in quote unquote reality, then we are projecting all those classes and nature knows no such classes. And then there's kind of two intermediate positions between these, which I think one is called conceptualism and one is called, I think it's another form of realism that's below Platonism. But this is like, that's going straight into like Western philosophy, and maybe we want to stick away from that at the moment. I don't know. Does any of that make any sense?
I mean, all of it makes sense, and there is a part of me that giggles about it because it is almost directly, you and I have had these discussions where sometimes I bristle at the kind of immediate discussion that I end up because I ask the kinds of questions that would ask for a historical or a lay of the land around Western philosophy. I often get like sort of lost in these perpetual debates still, right? And I have this kind of instinctual kind tantrum where I want to say, yeah, but can't we go back to this Buddha's middle way, and can't we think about without having to reference this whole body of Western philosophy? And so what I'm interested in about is not that tantrum, of course, but whether you think it is required or important to have a deep knowledge of the abstract theoretical thinking that has gone on to this day, I mean, to the extent that one person can, before there can be a settling into sort of a practical lived philosophy that may end up actually being much closer to a Taoist or Buddhist way of feeling and thinking in the world, in your everyday world.
So it's a great question. I mean, I kind of like I have I am kind of split in terms of dichotomies, and I go very hard on the theoretical side, and I get really interested in that. But I also think that things have to end up in practice, or else they kind of remain sterile or useless, basically. Although not the good kind of useless that the Taoists like. And it's an interesting question because I mean this kind of came up yesterday in the conversation with Sam as well, which is the historicity of ideas, right? Which is very present in Nietzsche, which is that anything that we think of as a solid, the most solid conceptual ground, actually itself has a history. And so, in some sense, like my interest in going into the history is not because, Western philosophy settles this debate and tells you what the relationship between the universal and the particular is. In fact, it does quite the opposite. Like it kind of ends up tending to confuse you. But
Reify, yeah.
yeah, exactly. But at the same time, like it seems important that these ideas themselves are cultural artifacts. So, for example, the claim that Sam made yesterday, which I think is, of course, brilliant, the idea that everything from anthropology, archaeology, literature, poetry, everything else just falls under history. And then, there's this kind of experimental split where, biology and chemistry and astrophysics and all sorts of other things fall under physics. Well, just think about those words. I mean, like history, by some, he was saying it just means a story, but in some sense, what we now mean by history in terms of like telling a story about the past, what like the kind of just general understanding of the word history, that's arguably like a kind of Herodotus or like a Thucydides, I can't remember who, some Athenian basically has this idea to tell that kind of story in this certain way. And that's the start of history, basically. I mean, like we talk about prehistory going back a little bit further than that to these kind of stelae and like, basically individual kings carving their deeds on stones, but we also kind of understand that that's more like propaganda. It doesn't really seem to have this balanced view that we want history to have. So what I'm saying in that case is history is invented, and physis or phusis or whatever is this kind of word for nature that also comes out of ancient Greece, and so it too has a history. So in a way, like my interest in the theoretical background of these things is not to remain in the realm of theory, but actually just to call attention to the fact that even the most stable constructs, that even the words that we use seemingly the most transparently themselves have a history and therefore are a kind of tool made up by, groups of humans. So,
Sure. I mean, I think that's really useful. And just for those who are listening, we will open it up in like a few minutes to everyone's interest. And we will, I think we will get to some very kind of concrete dichotomies or categories out of which we might, wonder whether they're useful and if they're not, how to sort of come out of that type of thinking. So I'm just putting a bookmark there and going back to your point, Ryan. So here's my question. I'll put it in very practical terms right after the question, which is if you're spending, and I'm talking about myself as well, if we are spending, let's say, 80% of our time in this playful realm of abstractions. And as Annie Dillard says, how we spend our days is how, after all, we spend our lives. Are we not actually in practice doing almost the precise thing that we're countering, right? By saying that theory is important, but to only a certain extent, and yet we spend most of our time in that space. What are we doing both to our minds and our actual daily life experiences, right? And I think that's really important. And let me give you an example, very practical. So I came back to this interest in Taoism and categories and non-categorical thinking and so on through this weird back door of painting. I started watercolor painting or any kind of painting or any kind of fucking art for that matter, right at the beginning of the pandemic. Picked up my first paintbrush, was a terrible painter, of course, and went through a year and a half of painting terribly and so on. And then a year and a half into this, about 6 months ago, maybe, or maybe a little longer, I started to just look at some YouTube videos around Chinese brush painting. And it is like an absolutely opposite way of painting. Apart from the fact that you use pigment and water, that's about the only similarity as to Western watercolor painting. And in that in Chinese brush painting and in calligraphy and so on, they have a hugely rich theoretical understanding of basically many of the Tao principles in practice, things like using energy and flow and simplicity. And the entire point is to discard and to uncover and to go basically to the most basic essence of the experience of being in that moment. So yes. You learn how to like move your entire body to make one stroke. Mm. If you hesitate, you can see the hesitations immediately on the ink. So the water knows, and the water is there to evidence your lack of flow or your constrictions wherever they may be. And you use that as a sense of looking inward and trying to understand where that comes from and so on. And the best Chinese brush painting ends up being the most simple, the things that you look at and go, oh my God, it was like one or two brush strokes. What's the big deal? Mm-hmm. And yet if you've tried it, you know what the big deal is. It's almost impossible to make that kind of fluid movement feeling when you look at something like that. Anyway, so my practice of that has been trying to take away all of my understanding of shading and background and theoretical knowledge of, you know, how to add certain pigments and so on, and take all of that away so that I can come to this moment in time where I paint. And I feel like I just wonder whether I had to go through all of that practice in Western ways of painting to get to a point of experiencing and appreciating what I'm doing in the Chinese brush painting attempts that I'm making, or whether I could have gone straight to it and been a much just better person. You see
without
the real,
without see, the, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-mm. Yeah.
Well, this is like,
so, yeah.
I mean, they're both really good questions. So the first question is, you know, by reading philosophy or, and writing about it and things like that, are we just remaining in the theoretical world forever? And the second part is kind of about virtue in the day sense of Tao Te Ching, which is like, strength or, well, virtuosity maybe is a better way of saying it, which is like the sort of effortless mastery of something, like spontaneous action taken repeatedly until it becomes kind of second nature and doesn't require thinking. This is like a kind of aspirational thing within Taoist thinking, but very much not under like most categories of Western thinking, at least, even if Western practice does have to do this at a certain point. I mean, so it's a good question. I've been joking about this because I think there's that Wittgenstein saying, I've not been able to track down where he actually says this, but he's often quoted as saying something like, philosophy is the cure for philosophy or something like that. It's like, it's philosophy is the cure for the illness that you get from reading philosophy, basically. So then remaining in this theoretical realm, I do think there is something to going into examining these concepts and how they're constructed as a way of just, I mean, partly it is curiosity, but I also feel like I'm on a mission somehow. I don't really know why that is, but to go in and just look at the history of these things. And I think that the end result either of Taoist practice, which could be, I actually don't know what the physical ones are called. What are the physical ones called? Qigong or Tai Chi or things like that, right?
Yeah, Tai Chi is definitely one of them.
Yeah, and like, but also just like the reading of the two sort of primary texts of quote unquote Taoism, even though, as we may have discussed before, Taoism itself as a concept comes about like in the first century AD, long after these two primary texts are produced. And neither person would have understood, neither of the writers of these two main texts of Taoism, which are the Tao Te Ching and the Zhuangzi, neither of them would have recognized themselves as Taoists. You know what I mean? This is a later construction that groups them. So like hundreds of years after they're both dead. So like, one, that's kind of interesting, but what is the point of studying Taoism? Well, I think it is to kind of draw attention again to the fact that We typically do have a tendency, at least I have a tendency, and I think most people, within the West, again, another problematic term, but let's just go with it, have this issue of remaining usually in the idea that language is fairly transparent, that we understand what each other, that I understand what you mean by the words that you say, and that, dichotomies do sort of exist. Whereas Taoism is a way of challenging that and forcing you. I mean, we haven't talked about Keats, the negative capability, but I would say that like Taoist training and maybe inward training in general, meaning meditation and other forms, contemplative forms, are ways of sustaining higher levels of uncertainty. And so, Keats has this famous thing in a letter where he's basically saying that that poetry is dependent on this ability, or spe I think he's specifically talking about Shakespeare. So Shakespeare has this ability to withhold judgment, essentially, and to basically create characters that, are both fully fleshed out and understandable, and yet diametrically opposed. And so he can avoid collapsing into certainty. And so that requires a type of tolerance for certainty. And I can find the exact quote if it's interesting. I don't know.
It is interesting. And while you do that, maybe I can just go on around. I mean, this is why I wanted, in one sense, to talk about this. And clearly, this is a discussion that has seven parts or something like that. But the, part of the application, or part of the reason why I'm kind of so obsessing over thinking about practices that might help people get out of categorical dualistic thinking is because I find so much of the good work and living and interacting and being a social partner that comes from a place of generosity and so on has to do with holding opposing values in their tensions and not collapsing, not only into judgment, but but recognizing how fruitful or how important it is to actually sit in these tensions. So just as examples, from things like work contexts, right? You have, people will talk about how important it is now to have a flat hierarchy. Let's do a DAO, and have a network of distributed, power and so on. And, I've only participated in three of them now, but in all cases,
That's three more
there
than
is
me,
this
so.
insight. Well, what's so fascinating about them is that in all cases, there is this insight that emerges very much self-organizing from the actors in these interactions, where we suddenly say, somebody has to take this over. Who wants
Someone
to
has
take
to be in
this?
charge
Who
of
wants
this
to take the
part or
lead?
whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And even if it's temporary, there is this feeling of leadership is important. And of course, there are people who then say, I'll do it. And they might suck at it because they never actually did have a context in which they had to, productively lead a group of people who don't necessarily have to be there, right? So these dichotomies around hierarchical versus flat organizational structures seems so blah and banal and whatever it is, but it's something I'm talking to my group project team all the time about. I don't want to be the always the head boss, and yet there are times that it's required, and people are thankful for it, and so on. But the bigger point about that is that we are constantly in that tension and talking about it. Is it the case that I've taken over too much? Is it the case right now that it's such distributed responsibility that nobody's coming there? And it's because we've explicitly talked about ourselves not being one or the other that these conversations are more effective and more fruitful and efficient even, right? Same thing with art and science, right? It's we've talked about the fact that we want to combine art and science in the projects that we do, but the important thing is that we don't fall into one or the other category, and it's in that interface between those two types of ways of seeing the world. If they're first of all, you recognize that they're not that different, and second of all, that it's that conversation, it's that holding the conversation constantly in that in between that is so incredibly useful. It's almost like you start realizing it's almost like a hack to do innovative work more productively when you recognize this kind of way of working. Just like complexity science can be a very good tool for thought to hack a lot of problems.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I was thinking about that per Bach, early complexity. I think he was a physicist, but he was writing on complexity theory and like pretty early on in like the 90s or something. And he was one of the ones that drew my attention to the kind of experimental versus historical sciences divide. I found the Keats thing in the Zettelkasten, and that was John Keats in a letter to his brothers George and Thomas Keats. Aren't as famous, I don't think. 22nd of December, 1817, with my characteristic fetish for dates. And he writes, "I had not a dispute, but a disquisition with Dilke upon various subjects. Several things dovetailed in my mind. And at once it struck me what quality went to form a man of achievement, especially in literature, and which Shakespeare possessed so enormously. I mean negative capability. That is, when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. Coleridge, for instance, would let go by a fine isolated verisimilitude." Sorry, it's a very weird way of putting it. "Would let go by a fine isolated verisimilitude caught from the penetralium of mystery, from being incapable of remaining content with half knowledge. This pursued through volumes would perhaps take us no further than this, that with a great poet, the sense of beauty overcomes every other consideration, or rather obliterates all consideration."
I love that. And I love that irritable reach for facts or something like that.
Yeah.
It does remind me of somebody as he reaches for his Zettelkasten.
Even this opening, "I had not a dispute, but a disquisition with Dilke." That's how a poet writes a letter. And yeah, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason.
I love that. And it is, it's like an itch that you have to scratch, this irritable, like, oh, give me that other fact. And then there is like William Carlos Williams, who famously said, "No ideas, but in things," right? And so his poetry to some is completely banal and boring and horrifying because he really just took this idea to its extremes. And so he had poems that just simply in the most simple terms described what was in front of him. What was it? It was the chickens, the red wheelbarrow.
Red wheelbarrow.
So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. Were they white? Maybe they were just chickens. I don't know. Anyway, but this idea that there is nothing else but the thing in front, and to elaborate and to, to make more beautiful strips the actual beauty from the thing itself in life, in reality. I mean, I think these tensions have been there.
Other end of the spectrum, you've got like the 18th century poets who are always writing. I mean, Thomas Gray, "Chill penury repressed her noble rage." It's like personifying penury, which is like
totally. So we have chased away two other people. I was just going to say we could open it up and just hear what other people are thinking around categories. I could go on and on, of course. You and I could go on and on. Shall we do you? I don't
yeah,
know
let
the,
me show
I
it.
Can't see the whole name.
Hello. I am trying to invite you up to speak. Hi, Anirudh. How are you? I'm trying to invite you. Has that worked?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear
yes,
you.
Yes, we can hear you.
1 second, my volume is suddenly weird. 1 second. Continue, sorry.
Yeah, sure, no problem.
Brian, I actually
problem.
dropped a question in the thing. My internet connection's a little bad, so I dropped it in your DM. You can...
Oh, okay. Yeah, let me check. Okay.
Thank you
I will read
for
your dot.
coming and listening.
Yeah, thank you for listening. I am going to check that. Here we go. Okay, had a question about one of your first points you made when you can get to it. Dropping it here. Okay, you're traveling and don't want to forget about where we encounter these theoretical categories or paradigms in the real world. How much of studying this interplay comes down to having better models of the brain and how it interprets the world via the theoretical abstractions?
Am I audible now?
Where are we? Yes, I can hear you. Yeah.
I hope it was clear. Like, I hope it made sense. But yeah, that was because all of this is filtered and modulated by the brain, right? Like, so how much would you say that we can separate that our understanding of these theoretical models from the interpreter, so to speak?
It's a great question. I mean, one, because, yeah, as you say, everything in experience, whether it's a thought or a perception of the quote unquote real world, does come through to us through some kind of experience or thought. And it all seems to be made of the same stuff, right? And so, how do we distinguish, the concrete from the abstract if in the end they are all, boil down to either phenomena in terms of like experiences or of sensations, emotions, thoughts, feelings, whatever, or to go further, just saying, well, it's all neurons at the bottom, so it's just these kind of patterns, and I'm not sure if I have an answer to that question yet. This is why I have reservations about using words like reality and to some degree experience. But one, yeah, what?
I had the same problem because if you look at the message, real world would be in quotes.
Yeah,
It's just,
exactly.
even that is just like a percept, like abstracted away model of like an infinitude of things that happens every second, all the time.
Yes. Well, and I don't know whether it's useful, but I'm reading Tanya Luhrmann's new book, or it's from last year, How God Becomes Real. And it's about what the effects on experience are of treating unseen forces as real, which is done in many, many different sort of religions and spiritual practices and meditation and things like that. And what's interesting in what she observes as an anthropologist is that there's a kind of like mainstream anthropology view that says that Westerners have this special kind of mind-body dualism, or like world and thought dualism, where we say, oh, there's the real world out there, and then there's the world of imagination or thinking. And what she and then and the idea being that for traditional societies or people who practice these older forms of religion or animism or whatever it is, that they actually have no way of distinguishing. Like to them, the phenomenology of spirits is just as real as the phenomenology of, your couch or something like that. And she, as an anthropologist, thinks this is bullshit, basically, that all cultures, like the boundary is not a hard one because, because it can't be in because of exactly what we're saying, that there seems to be this, it all seems to be formed of the same stuff at the bottom. But that to say that it is actually, yeah, but that she thinks that it's not strictly a Western mind-body dualist thing. She thinks it's more fundamental, that people but interact with objects like, a table in a way that's very different from how they interact with an ob with a concept like a god or a concept like capitalism or something like that, and that all cultures do this, but just where they draw the boundary is different. So I don't know if that's at all useful, but
No, it is because like if you look at like I was reading a bunch of stuff in developmental psychology, and they do talk about this kind of thing as part of the developmental process, right? Like the ability to
I forgot what the test is called, but it's basically the next step beyond the peekaboo test, which is object permanence. Next step is basically like if they give the child some information and they ask whether another child would also have that information, right? So very small children are not able to, but as they grow older, they realize that there is a distinction between the sense of me having information versus a new person does not, right? So all of these are still the kind of abstractions. And apparently there were some sociological experiments which are kind of discredited now, where they showed that like quote unquote primitive societies have less of this ability to do this state of mind, object permanence, and like abstractions in some way, right? That is a consequence of like civilization and language and so on and so forth. So once you get down into the weeds of the data and the research, like we're asking very different questions there. So of course, like this. So your point is interesting that like on some level it does have to be global because it is the human experience. But
yes,
on some other level, obviously it is constructed.
And it is the case that we develop these abstract categories much later, right? Like Isabella, this is something you will know far more about. So
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, well, what I think is also interesting is that it's not just, so, you know, abstract categories, and whether you call them categories or there's this generalization ability that kids start to get that become more and more sophisticated and more nuanced. There's also just the fact that most kids and like basically most of the world is born into a language, and that language, from even pre-birth, in the womb, has some really profound effects on how we perceive the world around us. So it's not even around just cultural practices and, theoretical frameworks that constrain the way we think, but our very way of being with one another, of getting anything and seeing anything is constrained by language, as we all know, and as you know, Brian and I have talked about quite a lot. But I find it particularly important in this case to think about because, with, for example, just the basic way that we represent language in different cultures. So Chinese, let's say, with the ideographic and other ideographic languages. Written words, and Western or European Western kinds of languages that use the alphabet, they're so different in how they form the foundation of a consciousness growing up. And so in the most basic way, for example, because ideographic languages don't have necessarily the structure of a verb, noun, and tenses in the same way, you have a really different way of seeing the world, for example, or experiencing consciousness, right? So the fact that, for example, just to be really, really concrete, if you cannot talk about knowing without assuming that there is some who or what, which in Chinese language, apparently, in the written language, there is no the person who is doing the thing. There is just the doing. There is the talking, or there is the running, or the whatever it is. But it's not I know to be this, or and so on. So can you imagine the impact that has? Because the sense of self as central, not that they don't eventually get built that kind of sense, but it's much more diminished or much more fuzzy than it is in Western culture that immediately says there is a object and a subject, and there is a action that is the subject takes on that object. And I find that just kind of mind-blowing in terms of how basic that is and how much that can form the basis of how we can even think of self and other, or whether there is that distinction so clearly.
Mm-hmm. To give maybe like another related example, I think it's true for Native Americans and maybe early Indian civilizations to a certain degree that they didn't think of time as necessarily linear. They had like different conceptions of what time was and could be. It was innately cyclical, and when these kinds of very basic things change the cultural consciousness and seep into like how the world is interpreted, like maybe that also is a relevant like way to look at how these diverge and how these streams of thinking like were in fact they had like some very like fundamental differences, right? Like what you're talking about, identity and things like that.
Mm-hmm. I think Brian? That's, yeah, very likely to be the case. Yeah, I mean, well, we've talked about Lyra Boroditsky and her kind of work with trying to prove the weak version of the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, you know, showing that, you know, even if it's not the case that there, that language dictates what you can think, which was the strong version of the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. I don't know if we want to go into the, I could go into a bit of detail about what she's up to and what, and the history of that question. But the other thing is that McGilchrist, there are some people, I think Claude Hagege, this French guy who's also at that high school that I was tweeting about yesterday. Mm-hmm. He is a linguist that thinks that the Greek alphabet, you know, not, you know, people always say, oh, it's uniquely suited to philosophy, but it may be that, you know, that alphabet and the kind of explosion of vocabulary that happens between the 8th century and the 4th century or so BC is wrapped up in this issue of kind of categorical and abstract truth. And that, like, there are ways of looking at that period where you can actually see the formation of things like formal logic that don't exist at the start of that period, and they do by the end. And they're kind of seen by the end to be contextless. And I think that maybe some of that is what you're getting at, Isabella, with,
yes,
you know, with Chinese, which is that it's much harder to kind of make these. So just to give one example, in Chinese philosophy, the question of human nature doesn't come up until like 500 or 600 years later than it does in the West. They don't really have this idea that there would be something consistent across people or whatever. And then by the time they do, it comes up in like a very different form, because they're not thinking like, you know, and that's funny because, like, you know, that debate, of course, kind of rages to this day in the form of Hobbes and Rousseau, you know, long after the ancient Greeks, but you know, this question of like, well, left to his own devices, is man good or evil? And in Chinese, it's just like even hard to formulate that question. It's like they're like what would that even, like, you know what I mean? Like
how does the question arise then? Like, you said it arises differently. You said that arises differently.
The question between, like, of is human nature fundamentally good or fundamentally evil is one that, like, doesn't really arise in the same way in Chinese philosophy. There's even stronger arguments that there is no conception of anything called truth in the abstract in Chinese philosophy until a very late period. It's a very controversial claim, but it's not like a settled dispute that that's a crazy idea. Which is to say that when you look at these early phases of Chinese philosophy, you know, Confucianism, Taoism, legalism, Moism, and all this kind of stuff, that they don't have a sense that there could be something true or false, like, outside of a specific context. And so they don't end up with the same kind of, like, it's not that they don't have logic, because they do develop logic, like, they do have logic, but they just don't see it as relating that strongly to life, I think.
Maybe they just didn't agree that logic was extendable beyond, like, the individual human applying the logic, which is actually, like, a fair argument even today, right? Like, that you can't model this human, the basis of, like, game theory and a lot of decision theory is that there is a rational agent who is going to react the same way in specific situation. And if you don't have that definition, then you can't do all this stuff. If you assume that each human is so complicated and so diverse that they're going to react almost arbitrarily in any given context, then...
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And there's also, I mean, like, I'm kind of interested in this birth of logic thing, because I think it is related to this question of categorizing things. And one is that, you know, there's this question of, does Aristotelian logic actually come from India? And there is some evidence that it does. And also that there are much more complex forms of logic that are being developed in India, like sort of long before the Athenians. So, you know, 700 BC, 800 BC, something like that. One of the more famous ones is I have no idea how to pronounce it. I've never heard it said aloud. Katushkoti or something like that, which is, it's sometimes called four-cornered logic. And you come across it in Buddhism. It's the idea that propositions not only can be true or false, but they can be both true and false, or neither true nor false. And in some famous suttas, the Buddha like basically negates every form of these and then ends up with like eight different categories. You know, like a question like, does the soul exist? You know, like, does the self exist? And he says, it's neither true nor false, nor true and false, nor neither true nor false, nor not true, nor not false, nor, you know, and so it goes into these eight negations, basically saying that, I guess it's a way of saying like, the question is not correctly formed. But I don't know, like, it just seems to me that this idea that there is something, that truth is somehow out there and that we can abstract from each situations, and you read it occasionally. I mean, I read it in a Substack yesterday, the idea that I'm committed to the pursuit of capital T truth, and I believe that science is a way of getting closer to that truth. That, like, that's a very weird idea, right? Like, what, you know, it involves all these, like, metaphysical commitments that are not obvious to me. In fact, they're kind of like, I don't know, they seem to me like very precarious somehow. I don't know if I'm making any sense at this point, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. The idea of getting into a discussion of whether the pursuit of truth can be a useful one seems like a very large discussion of what that even means, or where people are coming from when they're asking that question. I am stuck with this still, like the logic, going back to the question around logic and the birth thereof, and wondering, you know, from there, whether is it a given? We've sort of started this discussion as it's a given that thinking in pure dichotomies or categories is limited or a problem. Have we established that already as a given, or have we explained or thought about the history of that thinking and why we take it to be a truth rather than just a principle of Buddhist and Taoist thought and others' thinking?
So, sorry, say that again, the beginning of that again. So
just basically the question
is it a
of
given?
Is it a given that it's bad? Like, categories are wrong and bad to think in terms of them. And I know we thought so, first. Yeah, go ahead.
This might be a good place to read a little bit of McGilchrist.
Yes.
So Ian McGilchrist wrote a book called The Master and His Emissary in 2009. And it came out, there's another 10th edition print of it in 2019. And so this is about the hemisphere split, right? The left hemisphere, right hemisphere, parts of the brain. But he also acknowledges that there's also, it's not a dichotomy, it's maybe more like a spectrum from the top of the brain to the bottom, to the brain stem, as well as the front to the back and all kinds of other dynamics and things like that. And he says, this is page 22. So he says, a couple of related points are worth making. I've heard it said that the hemispheres are more alike than they are unalike. It's hard to know exactly what this phrase means, but whatever it means, and sometimes in life, it is the differences that count. Donald Trump and Albert Einstein are undoubtedly more alike than they are unlike. An old banger and a new Ferrari are both cars with internal combustion engines and are in that sense much more alike than not. But when I am buying one, I am interested in their differences. Nor am I dichotomizing. Nature got there before me, beginning with a remarkable physical division at the core of the brain, which she has since made more robust through mechanisms of interhemispheric inhibition. which is, that is really fascinating because a lot of the
stuff,
because the corpus callosum is quite late, right? Like other primates don't have it. And it seems like it's mainly about inhibition, right?
Yes. Which is, absolutely.
Some dichotomies are valid, such as those between plants and animals, despite there being, at the microscopic level, some overlap. Others between, say, good and bad drivers are not. That is not a true dichotomy, just a continuous spectrum. Recognizing valid differences between two elements of a system is not to dichotomize. Some people fear dichotomies. Some people fear dichotomies are simplistic, but it is also simplistic to reject a perfectly valid dichotomy just because you happen to have a thing against dichotomies when they occur.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a lovely kind of summary. And this, you know, I continue, and I think this seems to me where I'm landing over and over, is that the dichotomies are useful as just, you know, kind of nailing the polarities and where they are, and thinking within within their terms, but resisting the necessary, except for the most simplistic ones that make, you know, some sense, as he's given these really coarse examples, right? But I think this, again, the practice of working and thinking and playing in the tensions are what's much more interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And it really does seem like people resist doing this in general. I mean, it's not just polarities around politics and polarities around whatever it is, but this idea that, actually, this is what McGilchrist is saying, is that these things are actually way closer than we really imagine, right? And we're making up the distinctions in ways that are useful for whatever purposes we have at that moment.
I was going to try and find the Einstein thing on... play. So what is he saying? Associative play, combinatory play. But I wanted to find the, where was this?
While you're looking for that, you know, one of the things around the inhibition issue around the corpus callosum, one of the fascinating things that is going on, because so much of it, what the brain is doing is generally inhibition, is these combinations of sort of combinatorial concepts and thinking and feeling experiences that happen as a function of different types of inhibition, right? So, you know, experiencing something while you're angry versus inhibiting that anger, your interpretation of the context or the experience is so very different, despite hearing or seeing the very same things to some degree, right? You actually aren't seeing and hearing the very same things given an angry state. And I just find all of that so freaking fascinating, because this is, it essentially goes to the question of what are barriers to thinking in non-dichotomous or non-categorical ways. And I think one of the biggest barriers is just strong feeling states or emotions. It's really hard not to collapse into an interpretation and a perception that's very, opaque when you're in a strong emotional state, right?
Yeah, and this kind of relates to being open-minded versus closed-minded, and kind of good faith versus bad faith arguments, right? Which is that, you know, it's very hard to be receptive or appreciative of you know, these kind of possibilities. Especially in states of anger or reactivity, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then that does relate to play as well, right? Because play is kind of requires these. Who was talking about this? Signaling play. I think it is Lerman, actually, again.
Signaling.
I think I was thinking about that.
Yeah. So you have to be open to those. Yeah, there's a flexibility, a cognitive and emotional flexibility that you have that's required within play, so that you can spontaneously kind of pick up on different elements of the interaction at that moment, right? And that's part of what's so interesting about finite versus infinite games, is this idea that if there is any goal at all explicitly stated, is to just keep going, to just keep the game going, then you're then you're very much on that kind of, you know, trying to build a context that affords that flow or like surfing basically in the moment with whomever you're playing with.
Mm-hmm. I found this section of Einstein, if it's interesting.
Yeah, read it.
Okay. So this is from his autobiographical notes. I think they were written in 1946, but they were published in 1949. Let's see. So he died in 55, I think. And he asks, what precisely is thinking? When on the reception of sense impressions, memory pictures emerge, this is not yet thinking. And when such pictures form sequences, each member of which calls forth another, this too is not yet thinking. When, however, a certain picture turns up in many such sequences, then, precisely by such return, it becomes an organizing element for such sequences, in that it connects sequences in themselves unrelated to each other. Such an element becomes a tool, a concept. I think that the transition from free association or dreaming to thinking is characterized by the more or less preeminent role played by the concept. It is by no means necessary that a concept be tied to a sensorially cognizable and reproducible sign, a word. But when this is the case, the thinking becomes thereby capable of being communicated. With what right, the reader will ask, does this man operate so carelessly and primitively with ideas in such a problematic realm without making even the least effort to prove anything? My defense, all our thinking is of this nature, of free play with concepts. The justification for this play lies in the degree of comprehension of our sensations that we are able to achieve with its aid. The concept of truth cannot yet be applied to such structure. To my thinking, this concept becomes applicable only when a far-reaching agreement or convention concerning the elements and rules of the game is already at hand. So, yeah, what he's saying is that you can't be trying to prove things. And so he thinks that thinking is free association of ideas, a free play of concepts.
Yes.
Without testing or proof, basically. And that the testing must come later.
Yeah.
Only when a far-reaching agreement or convention, which, you know, kind of, and he's talking about once, like, this state of thinking doesn't require, it doesn't require words, right?
Yeah.
It's not, it's pre-linguistic.
Yeah.
And yet once it gets words, then it can be communicated. But
yeah,
he's kind of implying that it can't even be judged until the rules of the game have been applied, at which point it seems to involve other minds, right?
Yes. And I think one of the other points there is that there is a element of sort of autopoietic, it's like digesting of one's own perceptions, non-linguistic sort of conceptual perceptions that are internal and need to be sort of not represented. That's the whole point. It's that it, but there is still some sort of structural integrity to the thing that is being thought that has to be sort of it has to be the product of a next input to the cognitive system so that, but it's not linguistic, right? So there's a thing that's being thought or a combination of things that are played with. And then that thing, that combinatorial thing gets to be the object or whatever it is that continues to be fed back on and played. You know what I mean? By like that re-entrant element is really important. That it's not just a thing that you're looking at and batting back and forth, but that you take it, you structure it, you combine it, and then you put that combinatorial network back into the cognitive system to continue to play and I don't know how to say the word. I don't know exactly the word that I'm trying to reach. Mm-hmm. And that is all pre-linguistic, absolutely, and can only be done in one's mind at that moment. Although I do think that there's something really interesting that he's also talked about when it's about social, like when thinking becomes social, and yet it's not entirely only linguistic. It's there's somebody who understands you and yes. picks up your idea in a way that is not necessarily the conventional nomenclature for the particular, it's not collapsed into the conventional framework yet, and it's held up for longer periods. And that's, you know, the beauty of being able to collaborate with folks that kind of allow for that suspension of
And I've thought before that this is one reason why, you know, in maybe not, I was going to say like effective groups, but, you know, like in within these, I guess, let's say when minds come together creatively or in creative projects, then it does tend to produce a new language, or language is used in like a different way. And also that, you know, this is probably a reason why philosophers love coining new words, because of this issue of defamiliarization, that, that if you think you know what a word means, you may not have the inclination to be like, what does he mean by this word? And if you don't have that kind of openness and curiosity, then you may like misunderstand what he's doing with it. Whereas the very annoying thing is that you have to like go into this kind of philosophy. God, I'm just thinking about this because Kuhn talks about this in science. He basically says, you know, a definition almost of a subspecialty is when it develops enough of its own language that it requires translation to be understood by other groups or whatever. And so, like, it's just, I'm not sure what to make of that, except that did I lose you? Sorry.
Oh, no, I just got back. I don't know what happened. I can hear now perfectly. Can you hear me?
Yes.
So I'm not sure quite where you finish, but if I could hop in one bit right there, I think what's really interesting, it goes back to this feeling is first thing, right? One of the really cool things is when you're still at that Einstein thinking level where you're playing internally and starting to maybe be able to play a tiny bit in terms of talking around this new idea. There is still this kind of getting to know the concept together or to alone. And there's that feeling that Goethe talks about around it, it's astonishment, right? That you have this feeling of having an instantiation, an individuated feeling now of the divine, of the larger, right? And there's a feeling of astonishment,
of awe,
exactly. And I just love that. I love that.
I guess what I'm thinking is like, it's not just that, you know, like when two minds come together. Yeah, I mean, it does involve awe. It also involves like creativity to coin terms.
Yes.
And there's like a, you know, the Taoists kind of have this, I'm sure Zhuangzi talks about it. It's like illumination, right? Mm-hmm. Which is like that there's a form, like saying is not just blowing breath, right? He's like, he's got this idea that, saying says something, right? Mm-hmm. But that what it means is not fixed. And actually, this was the same reason that Socrates refused to write anything down, was that he felt that text can't answer back, basically, and that everything should be kind of in this dialectic state. And in that understanding, like all definitions are working definitions, right? Which, you know, like you and I could agree to say that what we mean by, it always goes to capitalism or whatever, because that always starts so many arguments. But like, you know, if by capitalism, I mean, you know, something to do with the ownership of the means of production, and by capitalism, you mean the free market,
right?
Then we're going to have like a lot of confusion. But if we agree that we're talking about one or the other, and we kind of talk about that definition enough that we see that it's being used in the same way, because as Einstein is saying, it's a tool, right? When this comes together, then we can use that tool collaboratively. But the problem is, as soon as you get it out of that context, you're at risk. It doesn't mean that necessarily that immediately leads to a collapse of meaning and everything falls apart. But like, once you get out of this spoken context, then you're at least at risk of misunderstanding what someone else means by a word.
Absolutely.
It also destroys. But I'll give you a chance to respond.
Well, I was just going to say it also, you know, going back to the interpenetration idea, it also destroys all other possibilities, right? So not only is there this risk of misunderstanding, but there's also a kind of a necessary kind of annihilation of those things that are those concepts or ideas or potential ways of perturbing that particular thought with other more fruitful or proximal thoughts that could be important to integrate, right? So as soon as you go, hey, you get it, I get it, are we now on the same page kind of thing, and now we've nailed it, we've also said all this other stuff that was close by is not relevant anymore. And so that there is a bit of there's a true sort of loss or the commitment makes for that kind of, negation.
Yeah, and there is this, yeah, McGilchrist writes a lot about betweenness, and like there's something about that, you know, that it's kind of between two minds, and that it's kind of this, or multiple minds, and that it's this kind of, I don't know, it's shared, and that it's a tool that can be jointly used. I mean, Schopenhauer talks about this in this Birth of Logic thing. He's like, it used to be that at the start of every debate, right, like when you stand up and you're like an orator or whatever, and you debate someone else, everyone would have to like agree on, they would find the points that they agreed on before they started the debate. So they would say this, you know, you agree to this, you agree to this. And then when you get to the point where you disagree, then that's where the debate starts. And what's interesting is that he thinks that when they were doing this, they also used to have to specify like, oh, you know, like A and not A cannot both be true. Like basically just the rules of logic.
Right.
And then eventually they, through this tortuous process, they eventually say, oh, well, we're just going to call that logic, and that applies to all of these. But at the start that this was like, you had to basically say, well, one, it was a game. Like the use of reason, both in ancient China and in Athens, it was a game. Everyone kind of knew that it was not real life.
Yes,
right?
And
two was that in the beginning, there weren't abstract rules, and there wasn't even a concept that, like, it took them a long time to basically say, oh, what if these things are true independent of all context?
Right.
Things like non-contradiction and stuff like that. And we get these hammered into us at such a young age that we think they're part of the structure of the universe. But like Lerman makes the point that most, you know, like wisdom traditions and stuff like that are not only like permit paradox, but paradox is like totally central to them.
You know?
And so this idea that all those boring rules of formal logic are somehow constitutive of the universe is like one of the most ludicrous, you know, outcomes imaginable.
Yeah. You know? And if you then take those ideas, not from only what, well, it's associated is again the sense of self and multiple selves versus this unitary sense of self and possible selves versus and possible lives and those kinds of things. Because if paradox is allowed, you can also have differing impulses and you don't have to try to act as if there aren't these differing impulses and different parts that want to live different lives, right? And I think part of the suffering that happens is living lives according to some structure, whether it's a religious doctrine or whether it's parental expectations or whatever it is, but there's one self that is being built and constructed. And when paradox isn't not only not like sort of allowed to some extent or respected, but it's not practiced. It's that it like the worldview of paradox being kind of part of nature, period, isn't practiced as a perception. Then you have all of this kind of feeding to that very crystalline sense of self that's supposedly there and identity and so on. And I just think that's really, you know, not a small bit of what suffering is all about.
Yes. Yeah, it's about the stabilizing exactly. of this kind of static thing or conceptual thing into something that's not supposed to change and that's reliable and dependable and
exactly.
persists through time and isn't dynamic and isn't responsive
exactly.
in some sense.
Exactly. And I mean, there's so much that we can go out of that because there you also are selecting and being selected into all sorts of social contexts in which that unitary sense of self is reified or rejected, but then you're moved somewhere else where that sense of self can be continually, you know, fossilized or crystallized or whatever it is, right? So it's not just your own sense of self and raging against paradoxes and being able to like, but then also everyone around you that continues to fashion that.
Yeah. And somehow it's kind of interesting because it came up in Kuhn in my Readwise today, just this idea that like, it's like totally forbidden within science to abandon a paradigm without another functional one to replace it. Like basically, if you basically say, I think physics is wrong, then that by saying that you just say that you're not a scientist.
Right.
Whereas like you have to have some other new kind of model that you're falling into. And I was thinking about whether this is a general principle because, you know, people have these kind of, you know, ego death experiences, but if they haven't got something like a new pattern that they're trying to write, then they just kind of fall back into the old one. You know what I mean? It's like
really important. I think actually that insight.
Anyway, I think we can probably wrap it up.
We can.
I don't know. Is there anything else you'd like to
add,
say, reflect?
I think ending on the destruction of a unitary sense of self and the need for finding an alternative is a good place to end as any. I do think there are wonderful places we could meander through and we just got started, but I think it was a really fruitful and interesting and rich discussion.
Thank you Amazing. I think I got too excited and we maybe could have let some people on stage earlier on, but that's okay.
Yeah, it's fine. It's all fine.
Try again next time.
Yeah, we can do it in different ways also in just starting a discussion, having left off, you know, some of these little breadcrumbs. And yeah, we can talk about other instantiations of these discussions, but I really had a good time. So thank you for inviting me.
Me too.
Okay.
Okay.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Yep.